Good afternoon and welcome to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And once again, we are not live because of the situation with the coronavirus. I'm in my home. Lorene is in her home.
Mine, right.
You know, but the technology is interesting how it's changed everything that we can do this. 5 years ago, Lorene, we couldn't have done something like this.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's wonderful, quite frankly, that we have the technology and the ability to do this. I mean, it's quite amazing. So
it really is.
We just stay connected. Yeah.
It really is. Well, there is a ton going on. And again, the coronavirus is dominating a lot of the news. News for Jews, just news for the entire world. In Israel, they have what? 150 have died from the coronavirus. Is that the figure that you saw?
Yes, I think that was the latest news. They've got 129 people right now intubated, so they're on ventilators, but 150 people dead, unfortunately. Close to 12,000 people, I think, have been tested so far. Obviously, the highest numbers of cases were in Jerusalem with two communities in particular being hard hit, that B'nai Brak Orthodox community that they literally closed down during Passover, which I think it looks like it's helping to slow down the spread of the virus. They're talking about opening some parts of the economy again slowly in the next week or so. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I thought, Mike, the most amazing news, and we sort of touched on this last week, this is really exciting. It's that plasma-based treatment. So the report came out. This is the Israeli-based company Pluristem, P-L-U-R-I-S-T-E-M, Pluristem, which was utilizing its plasma-based treatment, cell therapy, a placental cell therapy to treat some COVID-19 patients in Israel, had 100% success rates, and they recently used it on a patient in America at the Holy Name Medical Center in New Jersey, also with positive results. And so what I understand it does, the cells are, and of course, you know, I'm probably going to say some of this wrong, I'm sorry for my scientists out there and my doctors, allogeneic mesenchymal like cells that have an
immunization, which is a hard word to say.
Immunodulatory is probably right. Immunizations mean they can induce the immune system's natural regulatory T cells. That's that production and M2 macrophages. So the way they explain this, in essence, is helping significantly reduce the dangerous fatal symptoms associated with the COVID-19, including the pneumonia, pneumonitis, etc. So, so far having really phenomenal results. But again, it's one of many current, whether it's treatments or vaccines that's out there being tested right now.
You know what surprises me? I have seen almost no coverage of this on the cable networks, the major networks. I saw this in the Jerusalem Post or something like that. But here in the United States, have you seen any coverage anywhere of this?
I haven't, but there's a lot of other treatments out there too right now. There's been a lot of news on test kits, on, you know, obviously in Israel and Technion, they're working on a fast test kit, like a no-touch test kit. There's lots of reports on different test kits, work on vaccines. I haven't really seen any news, though, talking, I don't know if it, I wouldn't say it's specific to this one. I would say all of them. I mean, if you dig, you can find articles on various vaccines and treatments being tested and worked on by a multitude of pharmaceutical companies around the world. And but I haven't seen anything specific about this, but it was very curious, interesting to me that it was, that they were able to use it on this one patient in New Jersey.
I mean, and they've had 100% success rate with people who were really going downhill very quickly, and had they not received this treatment, might not have lived through it. So that is really, really encouraging. Let me also say, in case people heard, one of my dogs might have been barking in the background. That's what you get when you have home studios. I've seen it on network too, so I don't feel so bad.
But
I've got the door closed. You know, I've got a studio office in my home, but it's not completely soundproof, and the dogs always bark at the most inopportune times. So I apologize.
I mean, I think by now everyone, you know, who's been working from home and doing, you know, self isolating, I think by now we've all either had a child or a pet, you know, interfere or make some awkward, you know, noise during a video conference or phone call. Everybody's trying to adjust working from home, like new life. But we finished Passover this week, so that was really exciting. We made it through.
Right.
And I thought one of the fun things, I think we mentioned on last week's show, but the Saturday Night Seder, the Starz Saturday Night Seder. Yeah, that was kicked off by Jason Alexander, that aired Saturday night on YouTube. It was so adorable. Did you watch it?
I haven't seen it, but it must have been really good, because I called my dad, who's 94 years old and living in Chicago, and usually he'll talk to me no matter what's going on. He went, "Can I call you back? I'm watching this this Seder. I'm just loving it." I said, "Yeah, sure, Dad." So I want to see it. I saw that there's still a clip available on YouTube, and I want to watch it. And I had a couple other friends that told me that they saw it and said it's just terrific. Did you see it?
I did. It's adorable. So I found it on YouTube, and they raised $2.6 million for the CDC, the CDC Foundation, the nonprofit wing of the Centers for Disease Control, through. But it was adorable. It was very funny.
More than a million viewers.
And by the way, if you're not Jewish, you'd still appreciate it. And they had some non-Jews participating in the Seder. They welcome it for all. It was fun. I thought it was well done, and just a great way to have some humor in the midst of the crisis, as well as in the midst of Passover. But by the way, speaking of that, you know, I know we talked about Passover movies last week, but this week, season 3 of Fauda came out on Netflix. So my husband and I have been waiting forever for season 3 to come out, and we started binge watching. Have you seen of the Fauda?
No. I don't know anything about it. Tell me about it.
Oh my gosh, wow. Okay, so I was very fortunate. I had the great pleasure of meeting the two writers, directors of the show. One's an Israeli Jew, the other one is Israeli Arab. So you got an Arab and you got a Jew working on this together. It's really meant to, you know, it's interesting because when it first aired, even I think Hamas said, you know, encourage, you know, Palestinians to watch it. And then you get and Israelis are glued to the show. Like both sides are glued to the show. Like, and the reason why, and I really appreciate it. It demonstrates the complexity of human emotion, of the depth and breadth, and just the multidimensional complexity of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Jews.
So it focuses on a family, or
it focuses on this group of Israeli operatives who work for Shin Bet, who in many ways that, you know, they have, you know, you got to remember, Israel has a lot of cooperation, security cooperation with Palestinian Authority. So you've got this whole element that's, you know, part of the security cooperation with Palestinian Authority that is going in and rooting out terrorists like Hamas and Jihad factions in the PA. The PA doesn't want them in there, so they're working there. So you got these men in Shin Bet who are then going undercover into Hebron and all over the place, you know, undercover in these villages, you know, trying to root out these terrorists and everything. And then also, in this season 3, I don't want to give it away, but they eventually end up going to Gaza as well. It's like literally you're on the edge of your seat the whole time. And the show is so great because it really does. It demonstrates like nothing is black and white. There are so many grays and things are so complex.
Who carries it?
Netflix.
Okay.
So season 3, Fauda, Netflix. You got to watch it.
Okay. Also, I saw the fifth episode of The Plot Against America, the story about where Lindbergh becomes Presidents, written by Philip Roth, and Lindbergh obviously was not interested in getting into a war with Germany and had some very anti-Semitic feelings and thoughts. And in this new, I think it's a 6-part series, it might be a 10-part series, I'm not sure, it's told from the perspective of a Jewish family. And it's really frightening. It's absolutely frightening on something that you would think could never go on in America, but yeah, maybe it could. I don't know. I thought that's on HBO, and number 5 just dropped on I guess Monday or something. We watched that. It's fascinating. I really recommend that one. But speaking of shows, did you see the thing? I think I sent this to you. In Saudi Arabia, they're producing a show about a Jewish woman. And it's getting bad reaction from some people in the Arab world because they say the show is trying to bridge the gap and make Israel accepted and Israelis accepted by Arabs, which I thought was...
Right. They're complaining because it's the normalization with the Zionist entity Israel, right? Which, by the way, we talked about a little bit last week. We sort of explained and gave the definition of normalization and why, you know, they're so opposed to it, why normalization is illegal in Gaza and you know, which is why that young Palestinian man in Gaza got arrested for trying to do a video online with some Israelis. Anyway, but yeah, so it's fascinating because, you know, you and I, we've talked about the Mizrahi Jews, some of them living in these countries in northern Africa, throughout the Middle East, Persia, for hundreds, in some cases, thousands of years. Many of them being forced out of their homes with nothing but the clothes on their back in the early 1900s. And they had nowhere to go. At the time they went to Palestina, they went to Palestine, which then became the state of Israel. And... but it touches on that. And so the woman who's playing this Jewish actress, she's a renowned Kuwaiti actress who's playing a Jewish midwife nurse. And the show itself is being directed by an Egyptian, Mohammed Al-Adal, and this is being filmed in the United Arab Emirates. And it's fascinating because it's got all these Kuwaiti and Saudi actors, you know, including the one pretending to be the Jew. The show is called Life of a Leopard, but it's interesting. The writers of the show are just trying to say, look, Arab Jews were very much part of our history, whether we're talking about Egypt or the Arabian Peninsula, and demonstrating that does not contradict any of our other assertions. And so, you know, they try to make this distinction between, you have to differentiate between Zionism and Judaism. You know, they say Israel and those living in it are Zionists, but we have no problem with Judaism and Jews in general.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding that this comes, it's produced by a Saudi Arabian company, but...
But Jews lived throughout the Arabian Peninsula.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know,
and Mecca and Medina. But you got to remember, I mean, Muhammad to the Jewish community in Saudi Arabia. You know, you're talking in year 700, you know, Common Era. So you know, we've been there all this time. So, yeah, so I thought it was interesting that, you know, you have this Arab perspective of what it would be like to be a Jewish midwife in the 40s in that world at the time.
Yeah.
So fascinating. It
sounds fascinating. You know, one of the, I'm hearkening back to the problems with the coronavirus, that in Israel there has been a real problem with the Orthodox Jews. And for those who are maybe not Jewish or aren't familiar, Israel is not an Orthodox country. I mean, the stereotypical thought for some people who've never been there is that, you know, a bunch of Hasidic Jews are running around running the country. It's a very contemporary country, and they're sort of separated, the ultra Orthodox from the general population. And there's been a real breakout of the illness in the Orthodox community because they gather together every day to read the Torah and pray, and that's been a real problem for the Israeli government. In fact, we have a real short clip from the BBC about how that has been so problematic. So why don't we go to that? Let's listen to how they're dealing with that in Israel.
עליכם להתפזר או שננקוט בצעדי אכיפה.
אתם מביאים פה את הקורונה!
This area is Mea Shearim. It's one of the big ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods of Jerusalem. The ultra-Orthodox community make up around 12% of Israel's population, but they're accounting for a far greater proportion of coronavirus cases. We spoke to some of the major hospitals in Israel who told us that of the virus patients they are treating, between 30 and 50% come from the ultra-religious communities.
Sometimes it's hard because they want to talk with their rabbis and we have to wait for an answer to know what's the next step. But the Orthodox community wants to know more and wants to help with the disease.
For people here, religious study, prayer gatherings are really a way of life. But so too often is a deep distrust of outside authority, of the state itself. It's really the word of rabbis that cuts through rather than politicians. These are some of the most densely crowded neighborhoods in Israel. People often live in very, very big families. People, for religious reasons, won't necessarily have televisions or radio or access to the internet. And so for that reason, it's been much harder for the authorities, for the state, to get its message across.
It's very hard for us because normally here in this city, we're always together. We're trying to do the best, even if it's much more harder than other places.
There's long been tension between some secular and religiously conservative Israelis, and all that has been exacerbated over these last weeks. Much of the risk from the virus for residents here is added to by levels of poverty and being in big families where it is hard to distance. Israel's Prime Minister says there has been a very positive change and social distancing is now happening.
There's a lot of changes. People like understand how dangerous the situation. The rabbis stopped from all the synagogues to be open. No weddings. Even bar mitzvahs. People didn't celebrate the bar mitzvah.
Israel's ultra-Orthodox families are suffering disproportionately with coronavirus. There's a new public health video in Yiddish, the language spoken by many, and now a major operation to help the sick involving the army and charities. The military is helping evacuate over 80s from one sealed-off city, while more areas may be shut down.
So it's tough for everybody. It's tough for everybody everywhere, you know?
It is. Although I do think, you know, the people in the B'nai Barak neighborhood and that community in particular really appreciated a lot of the restrictions. You're seeing some feedback now post-Passover, appreciation of those restrictions because it really helped make the community aware and focused and stop that spread. So, you know, I think that's, there are some positive things coming. I mean, it obviously had a huge impact, especially for it to come during a time of, such an important Yom Tov of Passover. Sort of shutting down a lot of the traditional gatherings and prayers that they would be doing. But I think they're making great progress.
Well, yeah. Let's hope that everybody can get along. Speaking of getting along, though, you know who's not getting along? Bibi and Benny Gantz again.
Bibi and Benny. It's the Bibi and Benny show.
It really is. Really, did you see the thing? Bibi now is saying that if the courts go after him, which they are supposed to do, there will be civil unrest in Israel. And then Benny was told that his time is up to form a government. They were supposed to get together after Passover.
So everybody, right? We thought we had after election number three. We actually we were going to have a unity government because Bibi Netanyahu had reached out to Benny Gantz and said, "Come join me. Let's form a unity government. We're in a time of crisis." Benny, after resisting, did come and say, "Okay." They made him the Speaker of the House, and they were working on negotiating to form governments and who was going to do what. Coming up Passover, of course, Yom Tov, everything shuts down, including government. You know, nobody's working. So, and Benny Gantz was running up on his 28-day deadline, right?
Right.
President Rivlin charged Benny Gantz first this time to form a government. So he had 28 days to put a coalition together, failed at that. He was trying then to do unity with Bibi. Bibi had made some concessions. And then that obviously failed because Rivlin gave them an extension, said, okay, I'm going to give you till Wednesday night after Passover. If you don't have a deal, I'm going to now, instead of turning it over to Bibi Netanyahu to form a government, I'm just going to turn it over to the Knesset and say, you all pick who you want as prime minister. So that is now what President Rivlin has done, because Benny Gantz couldn't do it. Although the news out there is that the two of them are still negotiating and trying to work out a unity government
behind the scenes.
I mean, look, the Blue and White Party is threatening to submit three bills specifically targeting Bibi Netanyahu to make it illegal for any member of parliament to sue as prime minister if they're faced with indictment. And so that's sort of like Blue and White's tactic. And, you know, Bibi's got his own tactics. Everybody's maneuvering and posturing right now. it's like same old, Groundhog Day again. So
It is. 5:59, I got you, babe. Did you know the significance of that?
Exactly. And then Bill Murray.
Bill Murray.
Groundhog Day.
What a great movie that was. I love that movie.
Classic, and maybe that's actually a really good movie to watch this weekend, because
we're all living it. Yeah, we're all I get up each day, and my wife will say to me, is today Wednesday or Thursday? I say, I got to look at my calendar and my phone.
Right, exactly.
You know, it gets confusing.
Try leaving. Mike, why are you still here? Can you please leave the house for a while?
That's right.
I was like, okay, can you just just go in the car and drive.
That's right. Go around the block. Get away. give me some. This has nothing to do with Judaism, but I played golf with a guy once. It was last summer, and he had retired. And then he went back to work. And I said, what was it? You needed money or anything? He said, no. He said, the good Lord decided that husbands should have maybe breakfast and dinner with their wife, but not breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. It just doesn't work out that way. I thought that was
exactly
pretty funny. Hey, listen, you did a great interview with Alan Zweibel. Why don't we do this? Let's take a quick break. We got to get working a break here, and then we'll come back and I'll let you explain what this interview is all about. You are listening to The Third Opinion on WNF 88.5.
To our everyday heroes, the medical teams, the first responders, the truck drivers, the grocery store employees keeping our shelves stocked. Here's to those of you working who can't shelter at home, so the rest of us can. Here's to all those helping to keep us safe, sound, and supplied with the everyday goods, services, and support we need to get by. That's why Community Radio WMNF is saluting those on the front lines of the coronavirus crisis with songs for everyday heroes. To honor an everyday hero and suggest a song to play in their name, call us at 813-239-9663, extension 150, or email everydayheroes@wmnf.org. Give us your name, their name, a brief description of their heroism or act of kindness, and suggest the name of the artist and song you'd like us to play in recognition of your everyday hero on Thursdays starting at 1 p.m. Please limit your voicemail to 30 seconds or your email to more than 160 words. To the everyday heroes on the front lines of the coronavirus crisis, thank you. From all of us at WMNF, your connection to the music and the news to see us through.
Welcome back to The Third Opinion. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we have an interview with a really talented, interesting guy that Lorene did. Why don't you explain about Alan Zwabel?
So Alan, who we had him in town here in Tampa not too long ago, right before all the shelter and restrictions came into place.
Right.
I wish you would explain why I was able to interview him. and he did a performance for us. But he is literally one of the original Saturday Night Live writers. Was at the original meeting with Radner and all the others when, you
he
know,
was the
they
first
went
one to, hired by the show, the first on air.
Right. And you know, and it's funny, he has this whole story how he became a comedian. Because, you know, he tried to go to law school. You know, he had to study to take this test called the LSAT, which is the test you do to get into law school. Failed miserably. His parents, you know, okay, you know, we'll pay again, study again, go do it again. He failed again. And finally, you know, his parents give up. They're like, what are we going to do? He's working at a deli. He's like, I got to make some more money. So this is back in the day when all the comedians would be at the Poconos. And so he would write jokes and he'd sell a joke for a dollar. It was like a dollar a joke. And he'd write these jokes and sell them to these comedians up at the Poconos. And they were hits. It was like he was making money. He's like, well, maybe I got something here. And so he started doing the New York comedy clubs. And then he met Billy Crystal. The two of them hit it off. They became best friends back in the day. And just a fascinating guy. Larry David is one of his close personal friends. But just, you know, really just fascinating, lots of funny stories, but had a chance to interview him.
And the first thing you asked, well, first of all, you realize if you hadn't made it into law school, you might be doing stand-up right now.
I don't know that. You do it on Sundays.
We do it on Sundays together.
Right, exactly.
But the thing you asked him to start off the interview was, what do you think of Tampa?
You know something? I didn't see a hell of a lot of it. I looked out my hotel window. And there's like a lot of water. I would imagine that's Tampa Bay. I'm staying at the Westin. And
yes.
So that's Tampa Bay. And on the drive here from the hotel, they show me where the Tampa Bay Buccaneers play. So that's good because I'm a football fan. And I think I've been here a handful of times before for other books. But
possibly.
I like it. I like it here a lot.
Possibly. And we always do book festivals. The Tampa Federation, JCC, we have book festivals, film festivals, and different events. So tonight, though, you're sharing a little bit about yourself, how you got into the role of actually being a comedy writer.
Sure.
You know, a lot of people think, you know, comedy is so natural for Jews. You know, a lot of times it comes out of tragedy. But how did you figure out that's what you were going to do?
Oh, I didn't figure it out. I mean, what I did was, when I was growing up, there was the Dick Van Dyke Show was on, and I used to watch it with my parents, and there was this good-looking guy, Dick Van Dyke, and he was married to Mary Tyler Moore, who was really pretty, and they had a kid, Richie, so there was a family and a really nice house in New Rochelle, and he spent his days at work lying on a couch joking around with Buddy and Sally. So I said to my parents, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. So it seemed like something that was attractive, and it worked out okay.
Well, it worked out very okay for you. So Saturday Night Live, being a writer when the show first started,
Yeah. What
was that like? I mean, I'm sure there's people listening who maybe dream about being a writer one day, dream about comedy. I mean, what was that like for you, that experience?
It was a dream come true. I didn't realize how great a dream come true it was until later. None of us, or hardly any of us, had worked in TV before. And Lorne just said, let's just make each other laugh, and if we do that, we'll put it on television. And, you know, it slowly became this hit, this cult hit, and started getting awards, and it became a thing. And it was, when I look back on it, it was the most exciting time of my life. I mean, I haven't been with the show since 1980. That's 40 years. But when I think back on it, I realize and maybe I didn't even appreciate at the time how much fun we were having and how revolutionary it was. Don't forget, back then there was no cable. There was no streaming. There was no Netflix. There wasn't any comedy on cable. There wasn't even Fox. It was ABC, NBC, CBS. That was television. And we were able to, you know, we were stuck in this little corner, 11:30 to 1. And at first nobody was paying attention. And then the word got out, you know.
It was groundbreaking. You had so many good friends, as you talked about tonight on that show. And in that time frame, and I think my favorite story you told tonight was when, for those of you who are old enough to remember that are listening to this program, Mr. Ed, the horse.
Oh, yeah.
When the horse, Mr. Ed, passed away, you know, you talked about with Gilda coming up with a skit of, you know, having Mrs. Ed on.
Yeah, we interviewed the grieving widow, and the grieving widow, once we were on the air live, sort of flipped out, and we had no script for what the grieving widow should say, because we didn't know that the horse was going to go nuts. So Gilda started ad-libbing.
I think that's, you know, for everyone who's listening, we would encourage you to watch that one skit. But you also shared a story tonight about Gilda and the Gary Shandling show, when she came on to the Gary Shandling show, and, you know, did something pretty groundbreaking in joking about her condition, but it worked. But it was also a very special tribute to her. Would you share that with the audience? I think people would enjoy
that. Well, Gilda had gotten cancer, and I moved out to California to do It's Gary Shandling show. I co-created it with Gary. And Gilda was a fan of the show. And Gary was an admirer of Gilda. And she had an open invitation to come on. And so when she got cancer, she got a little cold feet. She thought that, I haven't been on TV in 6-7 years. She was curious as to whether or not the studio audience even would remember her or recognize her. She looked different. Her hair was short, and she had undergone all this chemo, and she was on her way back, you know, but still she looked different. And but then she came to the conclusion very quickly that she had to do the show because her comedy was the only weapon she had against this disease. So she asked me, let's make cancer funny. And when she came on the show, the audience was unsuspecting. We didn't announce that she would be on it. It was a surprise. And when she came on, not only the audience, that who she didn't think would remember her, erupted with all sorts of cheers and applause because they knew what she had been through and they missed her. But she started doing a couple of cancer jokes. And it was incredibly brave, and she really believed that her comedy was the only weapon. And at first, when the audience heard the first cancer joke, there was a millisecond of a hesitation. Gee, cancer joke. But then, as if they all computed it the same way at the same time, it was like, oh, she has it, she could do it, you know? And the appreciation was overwhelming.
For those of you listening, we're with Alan Zweibel, the comedy writer, and he's talking about his dear friend Gilda Radner, and we appreciate you sharing that story.
Well, you bet.
So one of the other things you do is you've worked on Curb Your Enthusiasm. You've worked with Larry David. What was that like?
Well, Larry's my buddy, and Larry's been my good buddy since 1974. So to work with him on that show was very similar to the whole friendship. It was every phone call we've ever had. It was any discussion we had where it got a little naughty, but we kept it between the two of us for fear of being, excommunicated or pelted with hard things. And he's a genius. He's my friend, but I exalt him. I think that there are certain people in this world who think differently than everybody else, and Larry is certainly on that list.
Right. Many of us watch that show. We watch the reruns, and we could just see him almost bursting to laughing when he's saying some of these lines. Like, you see the actors, like, just holding back laughter and tears just trying to get through a scene. And I can only imagine that must be what your friendship with Larry must be like. Laughing all the time.
Oh, well, you know, look, he's a serious guy also. He's a person. But, you know, I acted on one of the shows. And when we were improvising the scene, we kept on surprising each other with what we were going to say. And the two of us were sort of like, all right, he said that. Okay, I'm going to do him a little better than that. And it was a little, it's not that it was a competition, but we got off on the fact that we were just doing what we do when we're together.
Yeah, that's amazing. So tell us what's next for you. You've done so much. You've written books, movies.
My 11th book is coming out in April. It's a cultural memoir, and it's my story. But it's me as a tour guide through all the different things that I've been lucky enough to do, starting in the Catskills and SNL and its Gary Shandling show, and the play that I co-wrote with my friend Billy Crystal for Billy called 700 Sundays. And the name of the book is Laugh Lines, My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. And it's about not only the things I've done individually, but the collaborations with Dave Barry and Martin Short and the people I've been lucky enough to work with. And so that's coming out next month. And also I wrote a movie with Billy Crystal called Here Today. We just finished shooting it. We're editing it now. And it should be in the theaters in the fall. And it will star Billy and Tiffany Haddish.
Amazing. So Laugh Lines, which will be out
April 14th,
2020. That's very exciting. And then the movie with Billy Crystal. So any parting thoughts for the community and for the listening audience?
I love your community. And I hope I'm invited back here. I think that now with everything that's going on, somebody during one of the speeches, I spoke about anti-Semitism and there's this coronavirus thing, and there's just so much to upset us. Yeah. So the hope would be that somewhere in the middle of all of this, people will find a little haven, find a reason to laugh, or just to forget about all this stuff.
Yeah, I'm finding a reason to laugh because as we are talking...
Yeah, no, they're taking the building.
There's like this bang,
walls are
bang.
You know, this is awful. I know.
Well, anyway, Alan Zweibel, thank you so much
for
your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That, you know, the chairs at the end, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because as I was hearing the chairs in the background, I thought that was just, people must wonder what, but you always do the interviews. The speaker is at the Brian Glazer JCC usually, and you do the interview, and the event has ended, and the people who work there obviously want to get ready for whatever else is going to be, and then we always hear the chairs.
Like, it sounds like bombs going off in the background. It's like, and it was hilarious too, because you know you can't see it, right? Because you can get like, yeah. But every time they drop these chairs or something, and it's like boom. Yeah. And you just look at me, and we just like want to laugh. We're like, oh, you know, it's like,
yeah,
I didn't do that. You know, it was kind of like that. What was that movie? Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Remember that stamp when they were in the library and the guy would go boom and
yeah. And everybody was like, yes, it was very funny. But I'm glad that you made a reference to that, because that cracked me up. But, so
yeah,
we get some really cool people that come to town that we have an opportunity to talk to.
We do. I mean, I you know, it's kind of one of the sad things right now. We would have had some really cool people here if we had our film festival and different things going on. So. You know, but we will again one day, soon.
Yep. Oh, and by the way, we remember last week we interviewed Barbara Rosenthal for Satyrs and Cigars. There was a link on the Federation page if you want to see it. It's a fantastic film, so I highly recommend that. Anybody who's been around Tampa for a while will get a smile, and we'll know lots of people in that film. So you can find it on a link at go to the Federation webpage and look for the virtual programming, I guess, is what it is. I think it's still up there. Highly recommend the film. She did a great job on that.
I got to talk about Iran for a moment, because, okay. You know, they love their cartoon contest.
Oh, man. Why does this always happen? Really? Go ahead.
I know. Like, in the midst of everything, what does the Iranian authority do? Let's have a coronavirus
cartoon contest, which of course is then just laden with all of these anti-Semitic, blame the Jews. The Jews are behind, you know, the takeover of the world, you know, COVID-19 is like part of their strategy. You know, all these cartoons which were posted online for, you know, had millions of hits of people looking at it. It's just so disgusting. I think Sharon Nazarene, the vice president of international affairs with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, criticized the Iranian health ministry related to this coronavirus theme contest. It just was so upsetting that so many of these cartoons, and you can see them yourself.
The stereotypical trope of Jewish people. It is disgusting.
Right.
You know, but what else has happened? There have been charges against governors who have closed down their states of being compared to Hitler. Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer has been compared to Hitler, and Jared Polis, the governor of Colorado that we talked about last week,
who
is Jewish, whose family was involved in the Holocaust, and he got really emotional when he talked about it, but he was compared to Hitler for shutting down the state. And you know what? What I don't understand, a lot of people I've heard and seen on Facebook say, well, people overreacted. The deaths aren't as bad as we thought, so why are we all staying in place? That could be the reason that the deaths aren't as bad, because we're all staying in place and we're not exposing each other. You know? I understand the economy is important, but to me, lives are more important than the economy, and this is.
And testing's important. I mean, I understand some people, the frustration. You know, for a lot of people who need to go back to work. There's a lot of unsettling emotions out there right now, and you know, people are like, look, you know, I don't have any elderly with me. I'm dumb. You know, I do this kind of job. I need to put food on the table. I need a supply for my family. I don't want to lose my job. Like, I think it's a really complicated. You know, it's difficult. I don't think there's ever an easy answer.
There is no doubt, and there's going to be a lot of strife for many people. I mean, just to put food on the table,
right?
You know,
right, exactly.
For those of us who don't have that worry, we are blessed, and we should never take for granted how lucky we are. Because there are
absolutely.
people that are hurting, that are going to food banks for the first time in their lives, and
that's right.
And they just I can't remember the percentage of Americans that don't have $400 on hand for an emergency.
And it's pretty significant. And, you know, just a reminder for people in Tampa, Tampa Jewish Family Services, which is located at the Brian Glazier Family at JCC, they do have a food bank. I believe they're still providing food for families. And, of course, if you want to make donations, please feel free to call them as well. I believe they are taking donations, certainly, for families. But some good news on the COVID front. I mean, the United States did give $5 million in aid to the Palestinians to help fight the pandemic. So definitely some news on that. Ambassador Friedman made the announcement about the decision to provide the $5 million for Palestinian hospitals and households. And then, of course, Israel also, in addition to the other cooperation and coordination in fighting the virus, is providing additional loan and money to the Palestinian Authority to help them in their battle internally to help stop the spread of it. So, you know, again, it's just, this is where, you know, you see that everybody wants to paint, you know, Israelis and Palestinians as being enemies, and I don't think that's so true all the time.
Look, you know, we talked about this last week. It doesn't stop at the border. It doesn't stop at a state. We are all in this together, and we have to come together and try to unify ourselves and protect each other, and maybe see that we have more in common than we have in differences, you know?
That's right. Although I do want to say one good news that came out of Israel this week, and I'm really excited. So for those of you who didn't know, Israel, you know, and that whole region has had a drought forever. And And, you know, that beautiful Jordan River, which used to be this massive, powerful river, has been like literally like a trickle stream for those of you who've been there. And it is finally, the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, is finally at like this threshold point of almost overflowing, where it has not been in forever, many, many, many years, probably 20 years or so. And so they are getting ready to, or since 2004, I think. So they're getting ready to release 5 billion liters of water from the Kinneret into the Jordan River, which is super exciting. So, you know, to have this abundance of fresh water, it's just, for that area of the world, water is a most precious commodity. And so to see this abundance, I think this is just huge news and huge relief for the people of Jordan, of Israel, Syria, et cetera. So it's going to be tremendous to have that water flow come in. But I wanted, there was also that one other fun story we had about Kelly Clarkson.
Oh, well, that's, I was going to say that's a good thing about bringing people together. Kelly Clarkson, the original winner of American Idol. She was the first winner of American Idol, right? Right, I think.
I believe she was. Yeah. She had a couple hit songs.
Anyway, yeah.
She's a judge on one of those shows now, too.
Yeah, but she released a song in Hebrew that the linguists say her pronunciation is perfect. It's a duet with an Israeli singer that I'm not familiar with. Are you familiar with her?
I'm Maya Buskila. Yeah. I'm not, but the song is called "I Dare You," and I'm so excited. She did a couple other songs too. So, you know, she did some songs with a French artist in Arabic. She did a song with a Canadian Moroccan singer, with a Spanish singer, with a German singer. So she's got a bunch of different, you know, languages on it. But you've got a clip, don't you?
I do have a clip. We're gonna play this, and if you want to see the video, it's also on YouTube, and the video is really nice. It's about people coming together and all that. But this is Kelly Clarkson. That's perfect Hebrew as far as I can tell. I'm no linguist. You know, the night before my bar mitzvah, I did an all-nighter with the... We had records back then where you would sing along with the cantor and
I just was having this conversation with my husband, like, the other night. Like, we're like, Doron, and pronouncing Israeli Hebrew names, and just the way he says it, I'm going... Where did you go to Jewish day school? You know, you got this New York accent on it or something. Like, that's not how you say the name.
It's
so cute.
Speaking of pronunciation, did you see the thing? Amy Schumer, did I send that to you?
Oh, Amy Schumer.
Schumer,
yes.
Yeah.
Her son.
Okay. She had a son, and his first name is Gene, and they had another friend whose last name was Attell, right? And so they named him in honor of their friend Attell as his middle name, last name Fisher. Well, what she realized, as they would say it, this is our son, Gene Attell. And she said it sounded too much like genital. It just almost, she and her husband freaked out and decided from now on his name is going to be Gene David Fisher.
Which, by the way, for those of you who don't know, Amy Schumer, she's a hilarious comedian. Yeah. So it would make sense that she would do that. I'd be like, oh my God, you know, I'd announce it.
Do you know she is Chuck Schumer's cousin? Did you know that?
Is she really?
They are cousins. I don't know if it's first cousin or not. Oh, yeah, yeah. They're close. You know, both.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Interesting.
A little, you know, I'm a compendium of useless information. And but I've seen them actually together. So that's a pretty cool thing.
That is fun.
She is so funny. She really is.
Yeah. And I can't remember the one movie that she did about a year ago. It was adorable. It was her, and she was just, she was really funny. I mean, she's a great actress. I know so many people love her. And I got to give also a shout out to Gal Gadot. So I love Gal Gadot. Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman.
She is terrific. I mean, she a beautiful, good actress, you know, great shape. Yeah, she's...
I love her. And she's got the adorable Israeli accent. And she's an inspiration for young women. So as we all wait for Wonder Woman 1984 to come out because it's been delayed because of this whole virus thing.
I wonder, I didn't go to any Purim carnivals. Were there any Purim costumes of Wonder Woman? Because you could sort of say that.
I have to imagine there were.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally didn't see any, but I can only imagine there would have been lots of them.
You know, you could sort of merge Queen Esther and Wonder Woman.
Right. So she did an interview with Vogue magazine this month. So if you want to catch that, you can. She's there's a whole piece on Gal Gadot with Vogue. So I bring that up. But she's just, you know what? She's adorable, and she's a mother. A lot of people don't remember this. She's also a mother. Served in the IDF. Did training for combat forces, which, by the way, is how she was able to do. So she did so many of her own stunts and moves in the Wonder Woman movie because of her training.
Well, but everybody in Israel has to serve in the army, which
that's right.
Which makes, you know, it makes for an interesting way of bringing people together and gives a different feeling for the state of Israel. If you've served, you know, put in your service, it really makes a big difference.
I think it's, you know, it's really amazing to, you know, only women are not mandatory combat, and there's various units and some only a handful go into combat in general overall, but there's many different things that you do.
Laureen, you hear that music? You know what that means?
Are we done? Yeah.
We have actually, we are done. This is The Third Opinion. I am Mike Deason.
Laureen Jaffe.
See you next week. Have a good one. Bye.
You are listening to WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for NPR News, then Sunday Simcha.